Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we bring you a Zoom conversation presented by the Woods Hole Diversity Committee celebrating Black History Month. I spoke with Dr. Walter Massey, an educator, physicist, and business executive whose memoir is titled In the Eye of the Storm, My Time as Chairman of Bank of America During the Country's Worst Financial Crisis. Dr. Massey is a trustee emeritus of the Marine Biological Laboratory and the University of Chicago and serves as the senior advisor to the president of the University of Chicago. Programming for the Woods Hole Diversity Committee is supported by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Marine Biological Laboratory, National Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Geological Survey, Woodwell Climate Research Center, and the Sea Education Association. Oh, Walter, my goodness, you have had some really prominent positions in academia, U.S. government institutions. You've served on boards of major corporations, and you write in your memoir, looking back over my life, I found that a willingness to be open to possibilities quite different from your expectations greatly benefits your professional pursuits. And that openness, I think, applies to your personal life as well, as you had an encounter with a stranger in Woods Hole who really kind of prompted you to write your memoir. And I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about that experience.
I will. Thank you, Ben, and good morning. I had been thinking about writing my memoirs for years, and people had asked me, why didn't I? And I said, okay, you know, I should one day. But I was sitting at the Woods Hole Golf Club, where I'm a member, tennis member, actually. And my two younger grandchildren, they were very young then, were taking a tennis lesson, and this woman sat down beside me. And we just started to chat, and she and her grandchildren were out there also taking tennis lessons. And she told me about herself. She asked about me. It was one of those people who draw you out. There are some people like that. And before you know it, you're telling them your life story. And she just looked at me and said, you should really write your memoirs. I never met this woman before. And I thought after I left and went back home, if this stranger, after a brief conversation, thinks this my memoirs would be worth reading, then I should really take it seriously and get started. So that's when I really took it on as a serious effort. And that was quite a while ago. It was almost 10 years ago when I finally finished at least this version.
Now, you grew up in segregated Mississippi. Another quote from the book, you write, at any point, I or any member of my family could have been falsely accused or deliberately targeted for some offense of which we were not even aware. In looking back, it's as if we swam through shark-infested waters, assuming that if we did not disturb the sharks, they would not attack us. In retrospect, I've learned that this was an optimistic assumption at best, and probably even a dangerous one. Tell us a little bit about what Mississippi was like when you were growing up there.
Well, I was born in 1938, so it was the early 40s and 50s. It was before any form of desegregation. So when I was young, everything was totally segregated. It's still, some younger people may have seen signs that says color white drinking fountain and color white entrances. That's how it was. You could only shop in certain places, and some you couldn't go in at all. You went to the movie theaters, you went up the stairs, outside on the fire escape to the upper balcony. And it was, some things were very dangerous in that society. It wasn't hostile every day. And that's why I said it was as you were swimming through shark infested waters as a youngster and not realizing that you could have done something that would immediately provoke an attack. Looking at a person the wrong way, a white person, not deferring, doing anything that might, a white girl, a white woman, that might be misinterpreted could literally, you know, be very dangerous, deadly almost. So that's what I meant by it. In spite of all that, I had a happy childhood because of my family, and there was a Black community that we lived in. So we didn't encounter whites in an adversarial situation all the time. We worked for them, or we met them in public transportation or downtown. But I went to an all-Black school. My mother was an elementary school teacher and principal later. So we had a not self-enclosed, but a fairly closed and comfortable and warm and nurturing environment in spite of the shark infested waters around us.
You also write about your grandmother, Betty, who worked as a domestic servant. And you talk about going to work with her and playing with the children that of the family that she worked for. And then, so you weren't even about five when it was determined that you were too old to be playing with the little girl in the family. And was this about the time that you noticed that skin's color would make you be treated differently? Or did that not occur to you at the time this was happening?
It's interesting when you write a memoir, someone's looking back in time, you have to be careful with what you remember, you actually thought then and what you think you thought then, because of your age. So with that in mind, looking back, I think that's the first time I recall now that really struck home to me about that we were different, that we were Black. Because up to that age, I would go to work with my grandmother on occasion, and I'd play with the white boy and a white girl for the Morris family, who were, for that time and for that period, we all thought they were a fairly benign, if not nice, you know, white family. They were not mean to my grandmother in a sense like that. And they were warm and welcoming, and I played. Until one day my grandmother said, well, you can't go with me anymore. And she didn't say why. And I'm not sure my mother told me, or one of my cousins told me that I couldn't go because the Morris family thought I was too old to be playing with a white girl, their daughter.
You mentioned you had a happy childhood, and of course your mom sounds like she was an absolutely incredible woman. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the family dynamics that you had growing up that created this happy environment for you, even in dangerous times.
My grandmother, we lived with my grandmother, my father, who was actually my stepfather. My mother got pregnant with me her freshman year in college when she was 18. Married my father. They didn't stay married long. Then she remarried when I was about three to the man who raised me, Mr. Massey, my biological stepfather. So my mother, my stepfather, and later my brother, Al, who was 4 years younger than me. And we were young. When I was young, we stayed with my grandmother, a small house. And I had cousins throughout the neighborhood, friends. We could walk anywhere. It was a dirt road. But it was a safe community. We knew everyone. And everyone was part of your family in some sense. Any adult in the community could chastise you or invite you in for, you know, milk and cookies or any other form of entertainment. So in that sense, I said it was a kind of a closed community. Whites lived not far away. And it's an interesting thing about the South is because whites and Blacks lived so closely together during slavery. Hattiesburg was not a plantation town, but still whites and Blacks were used to living next to each other. But it was totally segregated, unlike Chicago and cities I learned later, where they are residentially segregated, even though they might be legally desegregated. So it was my grandmother was really, I think, the center of our family. Very strong woman, an independent woman. And I recall she's the one who taught me how to read. And I remember very early sitting on her lap, she was reading to me. And even when we moved out and had our own home, our family, I would spend a lot of time at my grandmother's with my older cousin. So I got to know her almost as a second mother. Mm.
Yeah, so you've had a lot of strong women in your life, haven't you? You've had your grandmother, your mother, your wife. You're a lucky man to have all these great women in your life. We'll get to your wife in a little bit.
Right.
While we're still in Mississippi, I want to talk about you. You had a job as a young man as a cook's helper at a new motel, and that was owned by two white women, Margaret and Cora. And you know how kind Cora was to you and an early influence. Tell us a little bit about Cora. And in the end, she kind of disappoints you a little bit here.
I think it says something about the South at that time. It said this phrase, swimming in dangerous waters and not knowing it. Miss Cora, as I called her, co-owned this motel. It was my first real job. I started out as a cook's helper in the kitchen, and I learned how to cook. I still cook. I do all the cooking in the house, and I love to cook. And then I was promoted to the person who greets the guests and takes the luggage, a bellboy, even though it wasn't called that. And I'd stand in the lobby next to the desk where Miss Cora had her office, and we'd chat, and we got to know each other. And she had, and she just sort of adopted me as her go-to person. I was 15 years old, maybe 14, just turning 15. And she had this big pink and white Lincoln convertible, those huge Lincoln convertibles in those days, in the 50s. And she 50s, and she would let me take it home and drive it to pick up the help the next day, who all black, bring them in, and take money to the bank. And people around town sort of knew me as Miss Cora's boy, I guess they might have called. But that was a big deal. I could go to the bank, take the money from the day's revenue. And I had this, I don't know why I had it, I had this sort of weird notion that she might help me go to college, might even help finance my way to college. And I was standing next to her the day the Brown versus the Board of Education decision was announced. And it came out in the Hattiesburg American. This is the paper, the headline. And I was standing next to her and she was reading the paper. And she said, "Will you look at this? Can you believe this? We're not going to let colors go to school with whites." That wasn't the exact phrase, but it was something like that. And then I think it just dawned upon me that I had created all these fantasies in my mind about how she viewed me and how she viewed colored people then. That's the episode I write about. Yeah. I still, and that big disappointment, but I learned a lot working with this woman about work habits, discipline, orderliness, you know, things that got me off to a very good start in life.
Yeah, so she was one of your first mentors in a way.
She was.
Yeah. You entered Morehouse College at the age of 16 on a Special Ford Foundation program. What was that like?
Well, it was interesting. I hadn't planned to go to college at that point. I had planned to go to college. I didn't know where, but most of my family, my mother had gone to college, my older cousins, but they all went to Mississippi schools. Tougaloo, Jackson State, Alcorn, where my mother went. And one day, my mother was asked to take a group of students to Jackson, Mississippi, the capital, to take a test for this special scholarship that the Ford Foundation was offering. And I went along with her. I wasn't one of the students asked to go because I was not seen as a particularly dedicated and disciplined student. My friends and I had a jazz band when we were started in the sixth grade. So they used to call it playing hooky. I actually missed classes a lot to play in our jazz band. So anyway, I went along and I took the test since I was there. They asked me, they said, "Well, you're here, you may as well take it." And it turns out I was the only one who I just did well enough to get this Ford Foundation scholarship to go to Morehouse out of the 10th grade. So we were totally unprepared. My mother was in favor of it. My father thought I was too young to leave. And the family was mixed on it. But I went with the support of everyone. And going to Morehouse changed my life. Literally, I think everything that happened after that that put me on the path to success was because I went to Morehouse. And I think not staying in Mississippi for those last 2 years also made a big difference. Hmm.
Two questions already that are similar. Kenneth writes, he would very much like to know how you became interested in physics and when you decided to pursue this as a career. And John is also asking, so he says, my question is, what influenced you to pursue science in a time that was tumultuous of a fellow Black man?
Well, I didn't tinker as a kid, as many scientists did. And when I went to Morehouse, I knew nothing about physics because I went out of the 10th grade. I hadn't had many courses. I hadn't had trigonometry, even geometry. I hadn't had physics or chemistry. I think I had biology. So when I got to Morehouse, I learned about these subjects. And I wanted to do something. I liked math, first of all. I always liked math, arithmetic when I was young. And I was not a mathophobic like many people. I liked it, mathophile, like I did as a kid. So I took math courses at Morehouse, and I had very good teachers. They had very good nurturing teachers who helped those of us who hadn't finished college. There were 15 of us in my class who were early admits. And I took the physics course, and actually, beyond, I took the physics course because everyone said no one takes majors in physics. And I hadn't intended to major in it, but I said, I'm going to take it. And I took it because even in the South, being from Mississippi was being at the bottom of the barrel, even for people from Georgia and Alabama. And they would kid me about being from Mississippi. So I said, okay, I'm going to take this physics. And I liked it. And I had this wonderful teacher, Sabinus Hobach Christensen, a Danish gentleman, Harvard PhD, and he was teaching at Morehouse. And I took the course, and I didn't do well because I hadn't had trigonometry and vectors. For those of you who are listening, if you don't know trigonometry, you can't understand vectors, and if you can't do vectors, you can't really understand mechanics, basic first year in physics. And Chris would take me aside after class and tutor me in trigonometry. And I only got a C, but I really liked it and I stayed with it. And I liked physics for a number of reasons. One, it was a way to apply mathematics to problems, try to understand the universe around you. So I liked that aspect of it. And also, as I got deeper into it, what I really liked, I'm a theoretical physicist, I was, what I really liked is that one can get absorbed in it, in a problem, where you're almost mentally in a meditative phase almost, where you're just totally absorbed that the world around you sort of disappears. So I like that part of it also.
You are listening to The Point. We will have more of our conversation with Dr. Walter Massey after a short break. You are listening to The Point. Today, we are bringing you a Woods Hole Diversity Committee Zoom conversation with Dr. Walter Massey, author of In the Eye of the Storm, My Time as Chairman of Bank of America During the Country's Worst Financial Crisis. I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, but this is a question that comes up a lot in the book. Once you became chairman of Bank of America, there was this question that you keep asking yourself, and why me, right? You write, my mind reeled. Why did the Fed and other agencies have confidence in me as the best person for the job as chairman? I was a physicist. Could I justify that confidence? So you questioned all of this confidence people had in you, but I guess going back to that quote of being open-minded and trying different things, you did a pretty good job.
In retrospect, yes. The help from some very good colleagues, yeah, we got the job done.
Yeah. So what prompted that question in you to keep asking, why me?
Well, it was an honest question. People read the book, you see that my becoming chairman was not a plan. Right. I was not part of a succession plan. I was chosen after the board was sort of forced to split up the job of chairman and CEO in most corporations in America. That's one position. And we had shareholders meeting after we bought Merrill Lynch, which led to quite a fine, a lot of questioning in the financial markets about whether that was a good decision. That's putting it mildly. People were angry that we bought Merrill. And the shareholders voted to split the position. And on the day of the shareholder meeting, after they voted, I learned that the board had selected me to become chairman. So it was a total surprise. So I hadn't prepared for it. And so the question was, why me? I'm not a banker. And I knew banking a lot because I'd been on the board a long time. I was the longest serving director. But there were several other people who I had been thinking that if it came to a vote when I was involved, that I would vote for them. And then, so I was chosen.
Right.
And that's why it really was an important and valid question for me to ask myself.
I would go back now to 1968. The year Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. were assassinated, riots, Vietnam War protests. This is also the year you met your wife, Shirley.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us a little bit about that. That was a tumultuous year, but there was some good that came out of that in you met the love of your life.
We've been married for 51 years, I think.
Yeah,
we got married
great.
In 1969. And that was good things that came out of my year, that year. It was a blind date. My oldest friend, he'd been my roommate in graduate school. His name was Avon Kirkland. Avon was a chemistry PhD student when I was a physics PhD student. And Avon was dating one of Shirley's girlfriends. And he suggested, said, you really need to meet this woman, Walter. And we did. It didn't go immediately to marriage, but after a year or so of dating back and forth, I was finally wise enough to ask her to marry me.
I want you to tell us a little bit about Shirley. You talk a lot about her in the book, and there's what do they say, behind every great man, there's a great woman, right? So tell us a little bit more about Shirley.
Well, she's not behind me usually.
She's right next to you.
That's the first thing, right? Out in front. Well, as I write, and she's probably listening to this, she's a very independent person. Shirley, it's very interesting, like my mother. Shirley got pregnant when she was like 18. Our oldest son, Keith, who I think is listening, probably also married briefly, divorced. So she was a single mother when I met her. Keith was 6 years old, worked for TWA. She had worked for Playboy. She's a very attractive woman still, but then she's absolutely stunning. And everyone assumed she was a Playboy bunny. She was actually a bookkeeper at the Playboy headquarters. And after I stopped really doing physics research, which is something I do by myself, when I went into administrative job, really we became a team, because starting when I was dean at Brown and director of Argonne, these are public jobs that you have to deal with the public, employees, and various constituencies, and Shirley's always just been great at doing that kind of thing.
I would say one of the things that stood out to me about your relationship with Shirley in the book is good communication, right? I mean, you traveled a lot, but you made it a point. You always talked to each other. Shirley would go to bed early. Sometimes in the book, she stayed up a little bit late to find out what happened to some of these meetings. But I think communication was a key part to the success in your marriage, don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, yes, definitely. I was thinking about that because I kind of take that for granted, you know, after all these years. And I think it was always pretty much there. The other thing we found out as we married and then later the marriage grew and stayed married long is how fortunate we were, and we tell ourselves that even now, that we liked the same thing. I didn't know this. I mean, I knew she liked jazz and music, but now I didn't know she was just as much a fanatic as I am, and that she would go when she was a single mother, she would go to jazz clubs by herself, go to the old London house here in Chicago to hear jazz. We like travel. We like dancing. We love dancing. And these things, it wasn't apparent that, you know, we would have the same feeling about all those things. Because we know a lot of couples who are very happily married, but they don't necessarily enjoy the same things as much as, you know, we do.
Right.
She doesn't like to go to movies. That's the only thing. And I love movies.
I love movies, yeah. And we should mention for listeners, if you have questions, you can write them in the Q&A column there, and I'll be happy to ask your questions for you. One of the other things you say in the book is, I've learned too that people make a difference in your life. So many of my door openings have come about because I got to know someone who was impressed with me personally. I'm thinking that maybe likely happened more often than you would even know. And I'm thinking of the instance when you bought your first house in Woods Hole. This was a house maybe that was a little bit out of your price range, but the owners decided they wanted to sell it to you because you had been nice to their daughter when you were Dean of Brown.
That's right. That's right. This the house was actually in West Falmouth. That
West
first
Falmouth.
House.
Okay, right.
West Falmouth. And that's when I was Dean of Brown. And we had friends who had places on the Cape or the Vineyard. And we would go down and visit. And then we were living in the Dean's house. We had a house. So we said, well, we could sell our house and maybe we can afford something on the Cape. And we looked around. We didn't see anything that we liked that we could afford. And we had a very good realtor. Her name was Alice Morris. I don't know if anyone's listening to Alice. They're a long time ago. Her husband, Bob Morris, had been Dean at Brown. He was a physicist also. And he was an associate director at Woods Hole. So Bob and Alice, Woods Hole Oceanographic, would invite us down to visit. And so Alice began to look for places. And one day I was in the office and Shirley called and said, I'm here with Alice on the Cape and we found a place. I said, I can't come down there, I'm working. She said, you really need to. And so I jumped in the car and I wrote, got there. Then there was no traffic in those days, 74, 76, so I got there. And we looked, it was gorgeous. It was right across from Sipawissa Bay, marsh there, gorgeous sunset view, an old farmhouse with a white picket fence. It was like out of your dreams. And I said, well, I looked at the price. I said, we can't afford this. And Alice said, well, Walter, the Douthats, the name, been in that family for generations. The Douthats had said they'd like to have you to have the place and they are going to drop the price. And it was dropped tremendously. I said, well, God, okay. Maybe we can afford it. And later I asked Alice, why on earth did they do that? She said, their daughter convinced them to sell it to you because she thought you and your family would love it and they'd like you to have it because their daughter, who was a student at Brown, said you had been so good to her and other students. And I have to say, I didn't even remember the young woman. But doing good, you know, or being a good person or being nice to people, supportive, that's what I emphasize in the book, pays it off in life,
yeah.
Even if you don't realize it.
Right. We have another question. It says, I was wondering how his children have influenced his life and career. So this is a question about your children. How have your children influenced your life and career?
Well, we have two sons, Keith, as I said, who adopted when we got married, my son. And the younger son, Eric, they've been very important in our lives. They're both now hardly children, but raising them, it's like raising, it's wonderful to see them turn out well, turn out to be good people. And they gave us a great grandchildren, which is probably even more important in some ways. And we have three grandchildren. Keith has a son, and Eric has a son. And a daughter. And we were very fortunate also that later in life, we had the privilege of spending a lot of time with our two younger grandchildren. They would spend summers at the Cape with us from the time they were like 2 or 3 years old. And so it was like having raising another group of children all over again in our later age, which kept us young.
Got a question. And this is on my list. I was going to ask you about mentors, but I like this question here from Sangram. It says, my dear friend, Walter, I heard the story of Cora, your first mentor, despite the disappointment. And I'm sure you had a great mentor in physics at Morehouse, the man from Finland. But were there any African-Americans in the academic world who influenced you and your career choices?
Not my career. Well, Henry McVey at Morehouse taught chemistry. And that was the second hardest course after physics, everyone said. And I took chemistry. there was a joke about Dr. McVeigh that he was responsible for there being more Morehouse men going into the ministry than any other faculty member at Morehouse, because they would take chemistry planning to go to medical school, and they were not able to pass this chemistry course. So the second choice was going to the ministry. That was the son of the running joke at Morehouse. McVeigh was a legend at Morehouse. And he, I think this is right, was responsible for graduating more PhDs in chemistry than any other faculty member in the country, black or white, by the time he died. And they had a major symposium about that at MIT. I may be off a little, but that's basically correct. And he was always a strong supporter of mine. And when I went back to Morehouse, and he was on the search committee that convinced me to leave the University of California to come to Morehouse, something I was totally unplanned. And he was so proud that I'd come back to Morehouse. He had his PhD was from the University of Chicago, and he just loved the University of Chicago. And I had been at the University of Chicago, and I'd been a professor there at the University of Chicago. So to him, coming back to Morehouse and bringing a bit of the University of Chicago back, you know, was just wonderful in his eyes. Unfortunately, he died the first year I got back. Went to the hospital for a minor, one of these kinds of things, minor operation or treatment of some kind. I don't know the details, and unfortunately died. But Henry McVeigh was an early African-American academician in my life.
I wonder if you could share some thoughts about me. You've had a lot of great mentors, and I'm sure you've been a mentor to many. What is your advice, especially for those here in the scientific community, about being a good mentor?
I think you have to take an interest in the person who you are mentoring. I mean, a sort of honest relationship in that sense. Make sure you do things that allow them to trust you. I'd be supportive, but critical. Hold them to high standards and follow through, keep in touch. And if they're African-American, especially if they're African-American males, who are often quite reluctant to reach out for help, if you're mentoring them, you really have to be more forward and more proactive, because they won't always, and that's true of a lot of youngsters, but I say that having been president of Morehouse and knowing that and seeing that with African-American males, but really be proactive and reach out and make sure you're following through, especially if you are a white mentor to an African-American, I would say any African-American male or female.
Bear writes, how did you get interested in music and actually playing in your own group?
We were the Blue Gardenias. That was an old movie, Nat King Cole. I may watch that again now that I'm at home with Netflix. And Ralph, my best friend, we grew up together. I can't remember ever not knowing Ralph. His house abutted ours across the field on parallel streets. And we were always friends, played together, cut school together. We went out for football in the sixth grade, and we went to one practice and decided this is not for us. So we had to do something, said, well, let's join the band. So we joined the band. And I have no idea why I picked the saxophone, but I did. And Ralph picked alto sax, Ralph picked baritone sax. And we had other guys in the band, and we just loved them. We had a great music director, Mr. Black. And we learned music quickly, and we all liked what we thought jazz. It wasn't really jazz, it was a little more like progressive rhythm and blues. And we would go to the music store and listen to records and try to play the music. And then we decided, well, why don't we, I don't remember how it happened, we'd start this band. And we did. And we were quite good. We would play in the local nightclubs around the city. We'd play white honky-tonks, which could be kind of scary at times when people would get drunk and rowdy. And we were ninth grade, right before I went off to college. And I loved music. And I was very good at reading. I was very good. I could read music very well. So I played first chair. When I got to Morehouse, I played solo chair for musicians, first chair in the band and the jazz band. But I could not improvise as well as I needed to be a jazz musician. And now the person in the band, Walter Booker Jr., any jazz person will know him. He's a famous bassist and pianist. Walter played third chair, which he could not read as well as I could. But after practice, when we would just sit around and jam, he'd blow rings around me. And so I decided that I had a better chance of succeeding in life as a physicist than as a jazz musician, because I at least could do physics better than anybody else at the time.
Jennifer writes, on a related topic, I often hear from my Black friends and colleagues how instrumental the HBCU environment has been to launching their successful careers. What is it about that environment that makes it so impactful to you and others? And what can non-minority institutions do to try to achieve the same?
Well, it's very interesting. Great question. And you will notice now HBCUs are coming back into the public's attention generally, and there have been quite a bit of extraordinary philanthropy bestowed upon them in the last couple of years. The big difference is at Morehouse, for all my other HBCU friends, they know Morehouse Man. There's a saying, you can always tell a Morehouse Man, but not much. There's always this bit of arrogance. But all of the schools have their mission in helping you to succeed. It's not to weed you out. It's not to have, admit people and throw you into a Darwinian environment. For anyone to fail, the faculty that sees in some ways, it's kind of failure on their part, if you work. And then still in you a work ethic. And at the time I was in school, in a segregated environment, it was really drilled into us that you have to work harder. No, the world is not fair. The world is segregated. You are starting from a more difficult position. That's all right. You can do it. You can achieve whatever you want, but that's going to require things. It's going to require a hard work, persistence, an ability to stay on task. And also they spend a lot of time on personal development. The academic institutions, but also character development institutions. A lot of emphasis is put on integrity, moral, ethical behavior, and giving back to the community. I think what white institutions can, well, all institutions can learn from that is the things I've just said, to instill an environment where you take it as your responsibility to make sure, as a faculty member, administration, to do all you can to help students succeed, no matter where they might be starting from, and not to simply be proud of the fact that you can take, the top 1 or 2% of the brightest students in the country and make them even smarter by putting them with smart professors. I mean, you have to do that, and of course, that's a wonderful job. And I spent most of my life in such institutions, for as a matter of fact, as a faculty member and administrator. But I think more emphasis on personal development, nurturing, mentoring is something that all institutions could benefit from.
John says, can you comment on the role of strong male role models in your success, particularly in your family?
Well, both my father, who raised me, Mr. Madsen, and my, that's my stepfather, and my father were strong men. And I was very fortunate because even though my mother and my father, a biological father, were divorced early and he moved to Detroit and remarried, that they stayed friends throughout life. So I would spend time with my father and his wife in Detroit in the summers a lot, especially when I was older, and in Mississippi with my mother and my stepfather. And my stepfather in particular was a very, very interesting man. He did not go to college, but he had a very good job on a place called Hercules Powder Company. It has a fascinating history. It was spun off from DuPont after World War II under an antitrust settlement. And so it was a very enlightened employer, even in Mississippi. And I write more about that in the book. But he had a good job for a black man at that time at Hercules. They had a commissary where we could go and get food. And he also sold insurance on weekends. And he was a deacon in the church. And he took pride in the way he dressed. On weekends, he'd put on a shirt, maybe not a tie, but a crisp shirt. And I don't remember him having altercations with whites. So I don't remember him lecturing us a lot, my brother and I, Al, who was 4 years younger, about the dangers of whites or anything like that. But he just carried himself in such a way that we didn't seem to have a lot of issues. I'm sure he stayed within the rules. I don't think he confronted white people directly, but he was not abject in any way. And we could see in his behavior, I think, a model of how you can behave. So the person also, other outside of my family made a big difference in my life. And all of us who went to Morehouse was Dr. Benjamin E. Mays. Benjamin Mays was the longest serving president of Morehouse, 27 years. And he made Morehouse a national institution. He was Martin Luther King Jr.'s mentor. He gave the eulogy at Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral. And he stayed on campus. We were a small college then. And we'd see him walking around the campus. We called him Buck Benny because he looked like a cowboy the way he walked. We had chapel every day, called it chapel, but it was assembly, all campus assembly. And most of those assemblies were a half hour every morning. He would speak, and he would speak about things of the virtues of hard work, integrity, honesty. And he'd bring in other people to speak, white and black, mostly black, to us on these same kinds of issues. So Benjamin Elijah Mays was outside of my father and stepfather, was the strongest male figure in my youth.
You are listening to The Point. We will have more of our conversation with Dr. Walter Massey after a short break. You are listening to The Point. Today, we are bringing you a Woods Hole Diversity Committee Zoom conversation with Dr. Walter Massey, author of In the Eye of the Storm, My Time as Chairman of Bank of America During the Country's Worst Financial Crisis. Tammy says, what advice do you have for fellow successful Black scientists, educators, and executives regarding their role and obligation in helping young, aspiring Blacks?
I think it is an obligation, and obligation makes it sound like a chore. It's not. It's a privilege, and it's a joy to me. I don't think it's anything more fulfilling than to see that you had an opportunity to help a young person develop and grow. And I've always tried to make myself available to our youngsters and go out of my way to try to meet them. If someone tells me about some young person who's they think has a great potential, I would say have them email me. And people are often quite surprised, especially young people, that I answer their email. And we chat, and I call them back. I liked teaching. I really did. I enjoyed it a lot. I liked other things in life as I moved on. But working with young people, teaching them, and now mentoring them, as I say, I think it's an enjoyable and very important thing that successful people should really undertake. Mm-hmm.
And Katie says, your career has led you into so many different and challenging areas of intellect, science, arts, academia, banking, and more. What do you think you to pursue such variety? In what ways has it been rewarding or very difficult?
A lot of it is serendipity, I think. I wrote in the book in the introduction that the book could be called A Life of Serendipity, because things have happened. I was chosen to be chairman of the bank. I didn't pursue that. That's toward the end. But at various stages in my life, when I had the opportunity to move in another direction, it was not something I was pursuing at all. And quite often, it was in a different direction. When I was asked to be director of Argonne National Laboratory, I was dean of the college at Brown, and I was a professor there teaching physics. And we loved Brown. I mean, we really did. We still do. And we could have stayed there the rest of our lives. Many of our colleagues and friends did that. But I got the offer from then president of the University of Chicago, Hannah Gray. And I had worked at Argonne, but I never thought of myself as being a lab director. And I took the job after interviewing, and I liked that, and I got into it. And same thing as the National Science Foundation. I had no interest in going into government. I just really didn't. I don't know why. And I was quite happy here in Chicago as a professor at the university and overseeing Argonne. But we decided we'd do that. So to answer the question, I think being open to new possibilities. And that's another thing that I've been fortunate in having Shirley. In spite of the fact that when we were at Brown, and I said, you know, we have to think about what we might do next. And she said, well, what do you mean do next? I said, well, we might not stay here. She said, why wouldn't we stay here? I said, I don't know, something could happen. And she tells me even now that she was stunned. She just thought, why would we move? Because she'd never moved anywhere. She'd lived all of her life in Chicago. But she has become what she calls a professional mover. And when something comes up, I would say, well, what do you think? I think I'd like to give it a try. And her immediate reaction is, well, we have to think about selling the house. She immediately gets down to the practical details. How far is it? How will we, you know, what do we have? I said, wait, we haven't decided yet. But she's already ahead of me. Laying out a plan. But I encourage people to be open. You just don't know what will come about. So what are the benefits? If you keep learning, you just keep learning new things. I never would have thought I'd be president of the School of Art and Design, and that we are now ensconced in the world of art and design. We sure are now. We know people, we know artists, we know gallery owners, we know museum directors. This was a world that was just not alien, but it was not a world we knew at all. And that would not have happened had I not accepted a call out of the blue to come down to the School of the Art Institute on an interim basis, and then they asked me to stay. So I liken it to always going back to graduate school. To me, that's what doing a new job is, because you have to learn, you have to study, you have to put time into it. And I like learning, and I like learning new things.
Well, Dr. Walter Macy, our time has just flown by. Thank you so much. It's been such an enjoyable conversation. I've really enjoyed my time with you, as I'm sure everyone else has. And I'm going to turn it back to Larry.
I just want to say, Mindy, thank you for doing this. I've listened to you for years on WCAI. So wonderful.
Thank you.
To have you part of this.
I spoke with Dr. Walter Macy, an educator, physicist, and business executive, whose memoir is titled In the Eye of the Storm, My Time as Chairman of Bank of America During the Country's Worst Financial Crisis. Programming for the Woods Hole Diversity Committee is supported by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Marine Biological Laboratory, National Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Geological Survey, Woodwell Climate Research Center, and the Sea Education Association. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.